Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Edgy Ideas is proudly sponsored by the Eco Leadership Institute. We offer coach and leadership training courses, and we have a vibrant community of practice where international members join once a month for a webinar. Our focus is on co-creating the good society. To find out more, go to www.ecoleadershipinstitute.org, and to read my polemic blogs and essays, go to Simon Western at Substack. Thank you for listening. Welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas Podcast. Today we have a very special guest. We have Sir Kerry Cooper with us. Kerry is Professor of Organizational Psychology and Health at Manchester Business School. He's a founding president of the British Academy of Management, past president of Relate and of CIPD. He's a founding editor of the Journal of Organizational Behavior. In 2001, he received a CBE for his contribution to organizational and occupational health. He was knighted in 2014 for his services to social sciences, author and editor of over 250 books, the latest being Resilience in the Modern Day Organizations. Kerry writes on occupational health, on well-being, on women at work, on occupational stress. He has far too many honors for me to mention here. Kerry, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you today?
Oh, I'm doing fine, Simon. Great to be with you.
Good, good. We met back maybe 20 odd years ago, back when we both worked at Lancaster University.
Absolutely. Yeah, I loved it there. It was a great place.
It really was, wasn't it?
Yeah, I really, really enjoyed it and spent a good 12 years there. And then I came back to Manchester, mainly because I lived down here and it was a little bit of a schlep going back and forth. But I still have very strong connections with Lancaster. My wife's a professor there as well in design.
Okay. Yeah, that's a great university. And I really flourished there. It was wonderful for me and my career. So happy memories indeed. So Kerry, I don't know where to begin. You have such a kind of a wide-ranging body of work there. Can I ask you what first got you interested and inspired to do this work?
I'll tell you what it was. It was, I come, as you can tell from my funny accent, I come from the U.S. I come from West Hollywood, in fact. That's where I was raised. And I think the thing that influenced me the most is I come from Eastern European background. My father was Ukrainian. My mother was Romanian. Mm-hmm. And most of the people I mixed with were Eastern European Jews. That's where there was a whole community of them in East L.A., and we all had parents, none of whom went to university or anything else. And so I was one of the first people in my family to go to a university. I didn't even know what a university was, really, because we'd had no experience in my broader family. So I went there and I did a degree. And it was because I came, my father was a barber, so he was a working class guy, not well educated. In fact, he never went to school. Ever.
Wow.
I mean, that he was born 1903 the rest of it coming from the Ukraine and so on. He was working from the age of 10. But so I came from that kind of background. And I guess most of my contemporaries who went to university with me all wanted to be lawyers, doctors, etc. And I was earmarked by the community as you're going to be a corporate lawyer. Mm-hmm. You're bright. You can make lots of money. And then I took a course in psychology as part of it toward the end of you have electives when you do an undergraduate degree. So you take it outside your field. I was studying economics at the time and I took a psychology course. This sounds great. And what am I doing here? And anyway, I had to work the whole time coming from a working class background.
Yeah.
And one of the jobs I had, so I took the psychology course and said, this is I think I'm going in the wrong direction. I don't like the law that much. You know, I'm not into the money. I'm wanting to do something that makes a difference. And the thing that really changed my life was one of the jobs I had. I then went on to do a master's degree, an MBA. Mm-hmm. And here's the interesting thing about the MBA it was a behavioral science MBA. There was psychology, sociology. It was all about the workplace and how about people and things like that. But to do that, I had to work full time as a social worker in the most deprived part of Los Angeles, Watts, which was the black area. I was the only white social worker. And I would fit my classes in between seeing my clients. And they knew that. The city of Los Angeles said, that's fine. Do your degree. Just see your clients. Here's your clients. Go see them whenever. I saw such deprivation. It just affected me. And I said, there's no way I could do the law or anything like that. I got to do something to make a difference. I don't care about the money. Let the rest of them. All my other friends went to be lawyers. And most of whom hated it when they in their careers. They didn't enjoy it, but they became very successful financially. So that's how it happened. So I went, that profound event of seeing such deprivation and people in such need that, and the discrimination that was going on and everything just said, that's it, I've got to go. And then I met, just as I was finishing my MBA, a professor who was visiting professor from Leeds University who came over to UCLA. And he said, why don't you come over and spend a year with me?
Yeah.
I said, great idea. I'd like to. I need to clear my head because I'm not sure exactly which direction I'm going to go in. So I went to Leeds University for a year, and that's where I could see a path. Mm-hmm. And the path was doing something in the workplace to help people, given so many people work.
Yeah.
And given the stress of people who don't work and the people who do work get stressed, what is it we can do about it? And that's how it started, more or less. And then a big global company asked me to do something while I was doing my PhD and just got into my lectureship, said, would you come and take a look at why our very senior managers, this was a global company, are not wanting to move to more senior roles? When I started to interview them, so I was going to get them a report and everything else. And it was a good study because I had access to all the top people in this company, the top 120. And then I kept hearing the word, and this is before anybody talked about it. So this is in the 1970s. Nobody was talking the word stress. I kept hearing, do I need the stress? Why do I want to move to Berlin and take that really top job at six figures when I have a young family and I want them settled? And who needs the stress? I kept hearing, who needs the stress?
Yeah.
So I thought, and then I had a PhD student with me. We were doing this report. And she said, you know, we should do something on stress. Should we go back to the company? It was a division of ICI.
Mm-hmm.
And we went back and said, can we go back to these people and do a study using proper measures and things and interviews and find out what the hell's driving this stress? And how is it affecting their performance? How is it affecting their health? How is it affecting their families? And I was the first one with Judy Marshall, my PhD student, later became a professor at Bath University and at Lancaster, incidentally.
Mm-hmm.
And she and I really, I guess, were the first people ever to really take a look at the driving factors in it.
Yeah.
And that's what started me on looking at the quality of working life. How do we create organizations that don't damage people? I mean, the outside world damages us enough.
Yeah.
Right. Forget, we got enough problems with finances and politics and wars and all of that. What about the workplace? Can't that be a place where people get nourished, feel valued, feel trusted, enjoy it? Get up in the morning and want to go to work. And I'm sorry, it's a long lead up, but that's what got me into it.
No, that's so interesting. I mean, if I have parallels, I was a psychiatric nurse and then I became a family therapist in Liverpool, which was hugely deprived. It was like the 1980s and it was the post-industrial kind of collapse. And I saw poverty like I'd never seen before. And I'm working in the health system and the social service system. We had these dysfunctional organizations alongside it. We were trying to help these people and the organizations themselves were toxic and dysfunctional. And it's a similar pattern. I thought, you know, what this needs to change and we need to kind of, and I shifted my work into that field then. You've noted there that you picked up stress in the 1970s early. What themes and changes have you seen since the 70s to now around mental health issues? I mean, we hear so much about mental health challenges today. What patterns have you seen since the early days of noticing stress?
Well, I think in the early days, what people were doing was stress management. So let's run a program on it. Mm-hmm. Let's help you to kind of unwind a bit, get your priorities right, you know, meditation and, you know, all those kinds of factors. And I guess we're into mindfulness now, in the mindfulness generation, as it were. So I think at that time it was very individually focused. Mm-hmm. Not focused on the organization and what it's doing to you.
Yes.
And what it could do to enhance your well-being and your performance and your productivity, given the UK has a problem, for example, where we're bottom of the G7 on productivity per capita and 17th in the G20 on productivity per capita. Not very good. The leading cause of long-term sickness absence, about 57% of it, is for stress, anxiety, and depression. No longer muscular skeletal like it was 30 years ago.
Yeah.
So I guess the beginning, the 1970s, was what can we do? What can the individual do? What can we help them do? And any kind of technique, and, you know, let's find a one size fits all, and maybe that'll solve the problem, without thinking about what the actual culture of the workplace was and how that could be damaging. So what I've seen is a progression toward just stress management at an individual level to much more interest, and a really important development, this into how do we change workplaces for the better? Yeah. How do we get, as the CIPD call it, good work? Mm-hmm. How do we move in the direction of creating environments where people feel valued, trusted, rewarded, you know, all that kind of thing that makes them motivated,
yes,
feeling good about life, glass half full rather than glass half empty. And we are gradually moving in that direction. I think the biggest stimulus to that, by the way, is something that was a negative event, i.e., so before that, go up to 2008. Mm-hmm. And it was iterations of that stress management. Let's control that, make sure people prioritize their work so they don't have overload, et cetera, all the factors that cause it. 2008 was a profound change. That was a recession. It wasn't a recession. It was a depression.
Yeah,
that was bad. 30, 40% of people in all sorts of sectors, for example, the finance sector, lost their job. Profound effect. Mm-hmm. So during that period of 2008 to say 2012, where it was still pretty bad, what I think you found is organizations started to think, hey, wait a second, we've lost so many people. We're very lean and mean now. How do we retain and attract people?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the mindset of senior people began to change. The same time that was happening, by the way, we're getting more younger people in senior roles, like CEO roles and board level roles, you know, and senior leadership team roles, which was really good. So we had a mindset change in the people who were going in into senior roles in both the private and the public sector. Plus, we had that major event occur. And now their question they're asking themselves is not, I think this is good and it's a good reason we should be doing this, is because it's right to do. I think they saw the bottom line of it.
Yeah.
The bottom line is how we change. One HR director said to me in the finance sector, very senior guy in a very global company, I said, why are you buggers all of a sudden doing things on well-being? And he said, regrettable turnover. I said, it sounds like a great title. I think I should write a book on it. What does it mean? He said, we can no longer afford to lose. He meant labor turnover. We can no longer afford to lose anybody.
Yeah.
We are so mean and lean. So to retain them and attract the next generation of Zetters and young millennials, that's what we have to do. We have to create a different culture. So all of a sudden, their mindset shifted away from beanbags, ping pong tables, sushi at your desk, mindfulness at lunch.
Yeah.
Not that those aren't nice things to have, and to have a well-being day with smoothies. Nothing. I mean, I like them.
Yeah.
That's not strategic well-being. That's not creating the culture to minimize mental ill health and to motivate people in the workplace. So I guess that was where the mindset began to change. So this big negative event had a positive at the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that permeated, got even more advanced when we had the pandemic.
Yes.
Because the pandemic pointed to one of the key issues, in my view, about the workplace, which we underrepresent. And that is the significance of your boss, i.e. the line manager from shop floor to top floor. Number one issue.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Because your health, your performance, everything to do with you is about how you're managed to some extent. It's other things too. But that in the workplace, that's quite important. If somebody values you, you're going to give the extra, you're going to go the extra mile. They make you feel good.
Yes.
If somebody is command and control on a bully, that is doesn't help you whatsoever. In fact, it damages you. So I saw the pandemic illustrated how significant, given we were locked away, the line manager now becomes.
Yes.
How will that person recognize where somebody's not coping given they're working from home all the time? How do we manage hybrid groups? People working 100% remotely. And then post that, now we're in the hybrid world. And if you don't have an EQ'd, an emotionally intelligent line manager, you're dead. Because they have to manage hybrid workers. They have to be people who see that Simon, you know, I saw Simon in that meeting and he's just not himself. Mm-hmm. He's being very quiet when usually he's involved. I wonder if something's wrong with him. I think off-piste, I'll go and call him up.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Absolutely, we need more socially skilled line managers. And I think that hyped it up further to say, hey, now we're going to start looking at the individual elements that make up a well-being culture. It's not just, it's about the hours you work. It's about teamwork. It's about flexible working. But it's also about the having a different kind of line manager and training them. Because if you think about it, Simon, and this has always worried me, in the UK and the developed world, not just the UK, people are promoted and recruited to managerial roles based on their technical skills, not their people skills.
Sure.
It's not that doesn't come into it. You're a great marketeer, so we'll make you marketing director.
Yeah.
You're a great classroom teacher, we'll make you a head. That is not right. What you have to get is parity between people who get managerial roles internally or recruited outside. There has to be parity between their people skills and their technical skills. They have to have the technical skills.
Yeah.
There has to be parity between the two. And that, to me, is something they now have said, yep, we get it. These two negative events have turned us around. They've reset the workplace to look more at the substantive issues rather than just scatter beanbags around the office and ping-pong tables.
I mean, that's a very, very pertinent observation. I mean, I've been working as a consultant in a major car manufacturer in the US, in health sector, in the humanitarian sector, and in one of the leading tech companies. And you're absolutely right that that kind of a line manager role in all those different sectors is absolutely vital. That's the unchangeable. That really makes a big difference, whether the team's functioning, whether individuals are feeling motivated, feeling cared for, feeling held, feeling contained, as we say in psychoanalysis. It's in all the different sectors, that role is absolutely pivotal, isn't it?
You know something, it's really funny. So we talk about, we have a productivity puzzle in the UK. Okay, so our productivity is the bottom of the G7, as I said, 17th in the G20. And what are we doing about it as a country? We're saying we need better broadband. We need better equipment. Nobody mentions we need better people who manage other human beings.
Yeah.
They put that down because you know why? Because that's harder to do. You have to spend some time on getting those kind of people in managerial roles. It's a longer term thing, and it's easier. Let's just invest in these IT bits and this equipment. I'm not saying that's not what we need as well. Yes, we do need that, but that is not the cause. If I am an employee and I'm in a team, what determines, and remember what productivity is. Productivity is what Kerry Cooper produces in an hour.
Yeah.
Right? Whatever I produce, all right. And that production is to some extent how much I'm motivated by my line manager, by my team, by everybody around me. It's about people.
Yeah.
You have the right kind of environment. Your productivity, the amount I produce in an hour, in a week, in a month is a consequence of that. The equipment helps me, it's an add-on. To me, the more fundamental issue is the environment, the people environment you're in.
Yeah.
And that is the big thing that we don't realize. And that's about mental health as well. My mental health, if somebody makes me feel valued and thinks and gives me a sense of purpose in my role and recognizes me when I do a good job, it doesn't have to be by money. Carrie, that was really a good thing. I read that thing you wrote. That was fantastic. I saw your lecture. It was really good. But I mean, not have a nice day American style, but genuinely they mean it. I think that is so important.
Yeah.
And we're just on the verge of getting there where organizations in the private and the public sector understand that significance, but they haven't done the big leap yet.
No.
But they're in the process of doing it.
Yeah. I don't know what your observations are, but in your workplace, I'm finding a great level of disenchantment, I would call it, where we're in the public, private sector, nonprofit sector. People want to do well. They want to kind of have purpose. They want to kind of feel engaged. And at a surface level, they put on a performance. But you talk to them in coaching sessions and one-to-one, and there's an awful lot of disenchantment, people feeling like they can't perform to the levels they'd like to. They can't get engaged to the levels they'd like to. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think you're right. But who's responsible for that? I mean, you have some responsibility, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have a responsibility to let your line manager, whoever your team leader, whoever that is, to know that you don't feel that you've got enough, that you need want more creative work, you want more challenge, you want this, you want that. But unless so it's up to you partly to open your mouth.
Yeah.
But if you have a good line manager, a socially skilled, emotionally literate line manager, that person should recognize, Simon has great potential. Come on, I'm going to give him that challenge.
Yeah.
I think, or at least I can talk to him. His behavior has changed.
Yeah.
I recognize it because I'm socially literate.
Mm.
I'm not just the bottom line guy who says that was Simon's objectives and he hasn't reached them.
Yeah.
So I better talk to him and tell him, find out why the hell he's not doing it.
Yeah.
And I'll be pretty heavy on him to get to do it. That's not going to make you do it. So I think you're absolutely right. I see a lot of it. And I think it's a malaise we have, well, particularly in the UK, with such poor political leadership that we've seen over so many years. I think that's actually, I'm not making a political, maybe I am making a political statement, but anyway, I think the leadership is so palpably bad at a political level for now a good 10 years, let's say, that it's dampened the morale of everybody.
Yeah.
And I think that's fed into the workplace as well, where business leaders don't feel they can do what they need to do. I mean, we've got Brexit. We've got things that have tied their hands and made it difficult for them. So if you think about business leaders, funny enough, they're influenced by government policy, right?
Yeah, sure.
If they get frustrated and lack morale, and have less morale and less get up and go, that will seep down the organization as well. Yeah. So I suspect, because morale is pretty poor in British business, I think.
Yeah.
And, we're out of Europe. We just heard today, in fact, funny enough, the IMF said in the G7, we're going to be the bottom next year, the total bottom.
Yeah.
We're already at the bottom. We're just staying at the bottom. Okay. That doesn't help morale of people.
No.
And if we had better leadership in businesses, we got to get the senior leaders to be more positive.
Yeah.
If they can do, we have quite a few who are out there. The good news is we have younger people in senior roles. They tend to be more resilient, and we need more women in the senior roles because I think they have, I'm going to say something very controversial, but I don't give a damn, which is I think more women have higher EQ than men on balance. And the more emotional intelligence, we need more women in leadership roles. You know why? They have the better qualities than the bulk of men do. And we can, men can have these qualities. We have to find the right men in these roles who have those kind of things. And I don't think we have valued that in the past.
I think socially men have had it conditioned out of them, and women, the maturing world that they've been socialized in that way. And I think that they bring that to the workplace.
They bring the nurturing role to the workplace.
Yeah.
And nurturing is what we need. We need to nurture people, make them feel valued, trusted, give them autonomy to do things rather than micromanage them.
I felt quite emotional when you were saying line management and Simon, because I was quite battered by systems. You know, you're stuck in the health system and you're a bright young nurse and you want to try and change the world and you're doing some great work and you're getting crushed and squashed all the time, you know. And then I worked for a guy who's passed away. I think that's why I got emotional. His name was Mike Broughton, and he saw my potential as a 21-year-old. And he said, you know, Simon, you can run this unit. It was a young people's unit for disturbed adolescents. And he kind of promoted me to kind of run this unit. And he kind of just gave me that confidence and said, you know, I believe in you, you know. And it just kind of, I just flew with that.
It changes your life, Simon, doesn't it? It changes your life. I have the same one. I had a guy, when I was doing my MBA, a professor at UCLA who was originally from Vienna, and Fred Masur, brilliant guy. And I'm doing my MBA with him, and he says, "You've got something in you, Kerry. I'm going to mentor you." And a really distinguished guy, lovely man, European. He says, "The one thing that's going to happen is you're going to go on for a PhD." Me? PhD? Are you sure?
Yeah.
Not only you, but you're going to go to Europe for at least a year. You've got to get away from this culture. You've got to go to another culture. And he says, if I was you, I'd go to England. And he had contacts with the University of Leeds, and that's how I came over. Yeah. And he mentored me. He saw something in me I never saw in myself.
Yeah.
And if you think in my career, Simon, every time I've been at a different stage of my career, I've been helped by a mentor. Mm-hmm. Somebody who, when I finally got a PhD in publishing things and everything else, I still didn't think. I thought, I was suffering from what is that thing called? The imposter syndrome. Yeah. I was suffering from the imposter syndrome. And then somebody else would pick me up and say, no, you're good. Mm-hmm. Do that. Don't say no to that. Do it.
And
I think we need people who do the mentoring. Mentoring, I think, is really important. It's certainly important for women who tend to be less aggressive and ambitious in their career than they should be. They should be much more, because they have more to offer than many men do, it, particularly in managerial roles, but they don't. They undervalue themselves a lot. Mm-hmm. Not all women, but I'm saying a bulk of women do, and they need mentors, but men need mentors too, and people who make you feel good about who you are and what you can contribute.
Yeah. No, it's very interesting. Another question I got for you is like, you've been hugely successful. Like, I mean, really, really successful. And I've read your work. I know you're super bright. You're listening to you now. You're really on the ball. What do you think has driven that success and undermined your own personal success?
Probably number one, seeing the deprivation in others. In various roles I've had, particularly when I was a social worker and elsewhere, seeing people suffering from stress a lot in the workplace, in universities, in public sector bodies I've been involved with. I think my driver is kind of probably a negative one. It's linked to the imposter syndrome. It's deep down thinking that I'm not as good as other people think I am.
Yeah.
And it's like somebody said to me recently, "Kerry, you keep writing all these books. Why don't you just stop?" He says, "I mean, you know, you're very successful." And the driver is something negative. I have to prove to myself. So if I read a review of a book I've written and it's negative, I tend to believe that more than the positive one.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So the positive one, I say, well, they haven't really, you know, there are weaknesses in it, because you always know your own weaknesses.
Yeah.
Well, that guy got me right. Yeah. You know, the guy who got me, who did the negative review, The positive review? No, he got me wrong. I mean, there's that weakness and that's a driver. And maybe that comes from my parents coming from Eastern Europe and first generation American and being exposed to deprivation, not personal deprivation in others.
Yeah, you know,
all of that kind of fits in. I think the driver frequently in people, I once did a book, I interviewed a lot of entrepreneurs in the UK, top people, John Harvey Jones, all the top people in the UK many years ago. I called it The Change Makers. That was the name of the book.
I remember.
A colleague and I did it, and we interviewed him. And when we went to interview him, it was basically saying, what makes you successful? The question you asked me, right? And, you know, almost without exception, I should think 3/4 of them told me it was a nasty event in childhood, the breakup of their parents, the being rejected by their father. It went on and on and on. Yeah. And I was stunned. I wasn't even looking for that, because the opening question was, because I wanted to hear them say, well, what it is you have to be agile, resilient. That's what I thought they were going to say. Yeah. Well, I didn't have a clue what they were going to say. And my co-author said the same. But when we both started it, we wanted him to get comfortable. So he said, tell us about your childhood. Where'd you come from? Give your background. And inevitably, that's the most important question we asked.
Yes.
My father and mother broke up when I was a kid. I lost both my parents when I was the age of 10. I lost my father. My father went bankrupt. It went on. And when I was a kid and we were thrown out of our house, it was an early childhood event they had no control over. So the view was that maybe the motivator for entrepreneurs and successful people, some motivator of it, I guess Elon Musk would fall in this category, incidentally.
Yeah.
Because I've read his background, is that you have to gain control of a world you didn't have control over when you were a kid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. So that's one thing, but you still don't feel 100% self-confident. And all these great business leaders I felt very comfortable with them, because I felt that what I was experiencing of not feeling I was as good as other people felt I was, as successful, etc. They were saying the same thing to me. So I say, you've already made 2 million. You've made 20 million in your businesses. So why you keep working? Right? Yeah. Why you go? Well, when you sold that business, you made 20 million, and now you're into another one, and another one, and another one. Why? The driver.
Yeah. No, I share that. I mean, I got thrown out of school at 16 and came from a working class background. And there's a little voice inside you, like you say, whenever you publish a book, you get assessed, but there's a nagging doubt: is it really good enough? You know, or should I write another one?
I'm with you. I'm with you on that. And there has to, in a way, maybe there has to be some driver. And the driver may have to be not necessarily a positive one, not a nice, comfortable middle-class home. We had all the opportunities. I think, I really don't think that drives that much success. No. It may get you into Eton and ultimately Oxbridge, right? And you may, but nowadays, even going to those institutions doesn't get you necessarily the top job anymore. It did 30 years ago. Except in politics, where it does seem to get you the top job. So there's nothing you can do about it. You don't select people for roles based on the deprivation had in childhood. But I'm trying to understand it psychologically.
Yeah, and of course, many people who go through that experience, some don't become successful. Some become entrapped in a kind of a painful life or an embittered life, you know, and they don't escape. And those who do can really utilize that driver to kind of
absolutely
make the change. Yeah,
you're right. And I don't know what the differentiation is between those two groups, because some of them get overwhelmed by it and can't produce.
Yeah.
And others. And maybe it's the factor we mentioned, that somewhere along the line, almost everybody I talked about some mentor who saw something in them.
Yeah. Yeah.
When they themselves didn't see it. They had the driver, the negative driver. I need to prove that I'm as good as other people think I am or don't think I am. But somebody along the line, several people along the line, have to mentor you, have to see something in you to push you in the more positive direction.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's very, very important. Perry, there's one other thing I wanted to ask you, thinking about kind of psychological well-being in the workplace. We have this environmental crisis, and there's a lot of talk of doomsday, and we have this kind of hanging over us, you know, the climate change or climate warming. Do you think that has an impact on the general population you mix with in the workplace? Do you think that, or do you think we defend ourselves against it and kind of push it away?
Well, I think it's important. And now a lot of people, I run this National Forum for Health and Wellbeing at Work.
Mm-hmm.
And it was started 6 years ago by several chief medical officers of global companies coming to see me and a couple HR directors saying, Carrie, we need to do something about health and wellbeing at work. So we formed it. No money involved. We were meeting every quarter in a headquarters like at BT or BP or Rolls-Royce, Microsoft, et cetera. These are the kind of things, as well as the NHS executive, UK civil service, et cetera, are all in it. We're up to 50 now, but we look at topics, and it's interesting you should ask that question, because this year in planning how we were going to do what we were going to look at this year, we start sort of in September. And the first one on the topic was climate change and how it's affecting the health and well-being of people at work.
Justin, yeah.
And we brought a top guy, top professor from UCL, and he was a leading guy on this. Mm-hmm. He could show directly how the climate change is affecting the health and well-being of people in the workplace. It is a big topic. AI is another big topic.
Yeah.
And we're getting somebody to come in on AI. So we're looking at topics that are relevant and then trying to think of what we can do to help people. Financial well-being, concerns about the cost of living, because this is not going to go away for a while. And now what's happening in the Middle East is likely to lead to massive inflation yet again, because we're not going to have the oil, the gas. You know, this is going to end the war. It looks like it's some kind of war in the Middle East as well as Ukraine. So those kind of topics, I think, are really important. And people did say that. So we always pick these topics. And these are HR directors, chief medical officers, and directors of health and well-being of millions of workers. They're in companies and public sector bodies. And they said that. They said that was exactly the same question they asked the rest of us. What do we think? How is the climate change scenario going to affect people at work?
Yeah.
How is it? And we got this medic to come in, and brilliant science on it.
Yeah.
But we still don't have the answer. So now we're going to delve deeper into it and try to get it. But it is an issue people are worried about, very much worried about.
It's great to have a forum like that where you're really working with kind of people often in the university. You get into the ivory tower and you write stuff over there, but to have that kind of real connection with the workplace and senior leaders in the workplace and addressing these questions. I mean, when you think about it, we're living in a precarious, interdependent world. Like the precariousness is not going to go away. It's going to be increased. We're not going to suddenly get a nice period of stability anymore. There's going to be.
No, we're not. We haven't had it for a while.
No, and it's going to keep rolling. So we have to adapt. But workplaces, when you think about it, are absolutely vital containers for our emotional and well-being, aren't they? If we can get some stability there in a kind of wildly changing world and pressurized world, then it can add to kind of society's mental health in a great way, can't it?
Oh, I think that's what's important about the workplace. And I remember when these guys and gals first came to see me at Manchester Business School 6 years ago and said, we want to form this group. I said, well, you won't have time to do anything. No, we will. I promise you we will. Mm-hmm. And what they were saying is, if you think about how many hours we spend at work.
Yes.
Work is critical. It influences you to a large extent, either positively or negatively, right? Because you spend so many bloody waking hours at work, probably more of your waking hours than you do at home with your family.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, at least in the world we can partly control, let's get some action done. And I think they were absolutely right. And you're right on that.
And the driver is both altruistic and it's kind of pragmatic, isn't it? It's like, you know, they need a healthy workforce with good mental health and good well-being to be productive. And they want to do the right thing as well.
Yeah. And there's so much bottom line evidence now for all the senior people who were in any way negative about, you know, the soft science of human relations or HR. I mean, it's changed. We have a different breed of people at the top now, thank goodness. A lot of them admitting their own mental health issues, which really was almost more impactful than the data. When you had Antonio Heroria admitting when he was a CEO of Lloyd's that he was suffering from depression.
Yeah.
Big time. And then we had it in Parliament and we had it in Barclays Bank. We had it everywhere.
Yeah.
We were starting to be open up, senior people. The minute that happened, then other people below them felt, I can talk about this now.
That's right.
I can begin to talk about it.
That's right. One question about the, I hear a lot about kind of a new generation of workforce and like people are talking about a big gap between their expectations and what existed before. What's your view of the new generation coming into the workforce and how their expectations of work are different?
It's interesting this because they're called by the older dinosaurs as snowflakes.
Yes.
Right. In other words, they'll flip from one job to another job, one organization to another. Rightly so. They are not prepared to tolerate what their parents tolerated and got dumped in 2008 when we had a financial crisis. Their parents committed to the organization. Organization said, sorry, we can't. We have to keep the labor costs down. Goodbye. They saw that. That generation of Z generation and young millennials saw that what happened to their parents. And number one, they are better educated.
Yeah.
They're more digital and tech savvy. They don't have mortgages like their parents had, and their parents would get married at 25 and had a house by 26, right? They number one can't afford a house, can't afford anything. They won't get a house till they're 50 or, you know, I'm sorry, till they're 35 or 40. They certainly won't get it in their 20s or early 30s. Okay, so they have nothing to lose. And what they want is good quality of working life. That generation are fantastic.
Yeah.
And they're prepared to say, that's not a nice place to work. They're not very nice people there. They're demanding me be in 5 days a week when I'd like to work flexibly. They're command and control. They only look at the metrics, the bottom line metrics. They don't care about me. They don't give me the kind of training I need. They don't ask what I need. They just use me.
Yeah.
And they have a very good brand. And yes, they pay well, but I want to enjoy my job. I want to get in. I want to get in the morning and I want to have a sense of purpose. I'm doing something for the wider society.
Yeah.
So that those Zers, the Z generation, young millennials are our future, and they've got the right balance and they have the right value systems, better in a way than their parents sticking with organizations they didn't like, didn't enjoy, and tolerated it because they wanted to pay the mortgage.
Yeah. Very interesting. Kerry, it's been a brilliant conversation. We're coming to the end. I ask guests two questions at the end of the podcast. Through your work experience and your life experience, what does it take to live a good life and to create a good society? They're big questions.
Yeah, they are big questions. Thank you very much indeed. I think the most important thing is what can you do as a person? And just being kind to other people. It's not easy.
Yeah.
With all the stresses and strains, being kind, that is infectious.
Yes.
If you're kind, you know what I do now? There are times when I get really pissed off, excuse me, the language. I get really angry with somebody. I stop myself and I think, I'm ready to blow at this person for doing that. And I'm not going to do it because what if that was my daughter? Because I have four kids and somebody did that, what I'm about to do to this guy, somebody did to my daughter.
Yeah.
It would be devastating. I'd be very upset. Therefore, I stop myself. I say, just be calm. When it comes to that relationship, be helpful, kind, supportive. And there are certain people you'll never change.
Yeah, that's right.
Right? For me, it's glass half empty types.
Yeah.
I can't cope with them. Why you can't do something. Oh no, we tried that 12 years ago. Oh no, it'll never work. Mainly they don't want change of any sort. So instead of getting angry with them or fuming inside, I just avoid them.
Yes. Yeah.
For the ones I think there's no way they're going to change.
Sure.
But the majority of people are changeable. You know, they may say one thing, but basically you can convince them or you can come to a compromise. So I think being kind to people is a really good recipe, because if we had more people doing that, and it's infectious kindness.
It is indeed. And you've been very kind to give us your time. So thank you very much. It's been a great conversation. Really lovely. Take care.
Thanks, Simon. I really